Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, the huge interest in the ongoing industrial dispute at Aer Lingus reflects not just the concerns of holidaymakers, but the particular standing that Aer Lingus has had in Ireland since its establishment back in 1936, when it became the national airline. Why is that history significant, and what do the various triumphs and trials of Aer Lingus reveal about its relationship with our own national identity? Well, joining me this morning to discuss the history of Aer Lingus is historian Dermot Ferriter. You're very welcome.
Morning, sir.
And this is timely, isn't it, when we've had 76 flight cancellations announced this morning. We're going to go right back to the beginning, though, and I mentioned 1936 as the year of its establishment. Why did it take 14 years after the creation of the state before Aer Lingus came along?
It was partly because the state was not prepared to spend the money that was needed and devoted the time that was needed. Now, understandably, the new state in the early days had other preoccupations, very serious preoccupations, particularly with civil war. But that in itself was relevant because navigation and air control developments and so on had developed very significantly during the period of the First World War. And the issue of air traffic between Britain and Ireland actually came up in the treaty negotiations in late 1921, because Britain was conscious of Ireland's position. This wasn't just about politics, it was also about geography, given that it was the most westerly European country, its position in the North Atlantic on the periphery, and the potential there in terms of it being a hub. So it was raised, and there was a kind of a loose recognition that this issue would have to be explored in the future. And there were various interdepartmental committees set up by the government in the 1920s, and they were very tentative. They were looking at the possibilities, but it was just deemed to be too expensive. But Ireland was concerned that it wouldn't be drawn in to agreements between Britain and the Dominions when it came to air traffic and the control of air traffic. But they were also conscious that there had been a convention in 1919 and an acceptance internationally that national sovereignty extended to the skies above your country.
So it was all political, wasn't it?
Well, it was political, and they didn't want Britain to be in a commanding position when it came to Irish airspace. So this was kind of left up in the air in the 1920s. But, I mean, airplanes were used by the Free State side during the Civil War, particularly when it came to their campaign to defeat the anti-treaty Republicans. So there was a small Irish Air Corps there. And, of course, famously, there had been a plane on standby for Michael Collins in the event of the treaty negotiations breaking down in 1921. So it was there in the ether, but there was no development of aviation policy to any significant degree until the 1930s.
Okay, so then we come to 1936. Sean Lamass was Minister for Industry and Commerce. So what was his role in all of this?
Well, he was very interested in the potential. And the way he put it at the time in 1936, he referred to Ireland as possibly being an international junction. And he was forward-thinking in relation to the potential for trade as well as tourism, because this was never just going to be about tourist traffic. It was also about business and connecting Ireland to the world. But it also fitted the protectionist agenda for Irish Republicans in the 1930s when they did achieve power after defeat in the Civil War, the idea of being able to control that area. And this was when you had, in the early 1930s, you had, again, tentative agreements between Britain and Ireland that they would allow some private operators access to the Dublin-London route. But they came to realise that given international developments and greater liberalisation in relation to air travel, that there had to be an Irish input, or else, again, it would be dominated by British concerns. So they came up then with the legislation in 1936 that really gave the power to the Minister for Industry and Commerce, not just to inaugurate this new airline, but to ensure that he could keep out competition as well. So he had significant powers of regulation.
So then we come to the first flight. How significant was that day?
Well, the most important thing on the day was the Mass that was celebrated, because this was a very holy occasion as well.
There was a lot to be said for a Mass.
There was, and there was a degree of concern, of course, about the potential safety issues that might arise in these early days. So there was a Mass in Baldonnell. This was the inaugural flight in May 1936 from Baldonnell to Bristol. It was a 2-hour flight time. There were only 5 passengers on board. There were only 2 qualified pilots in Ireland at that stage. And it, you know, it went very well and it developed rapidly thereafter. So it was regarded as a very significant development. And there was a lot of interest on the part of private flyers as well in how this might pan out? Because there was an Irish Aero Club in the early 1930s and they had four airplanes in operation before Aer Lingus was established in 1936. But it didn't quite capture the public imagination in a serious way until a later stage.
Mm-hmm. And then we, just a few short years later, of course, we have the Second World War. So how did...
Curtailed everything, you know, okay, because of Ireland's status as a neutral country, but also because of the impact that the war had on air travel generally. And there was a lot of despondency within Aer Lingus in the post-war period. We know that from Gerry Dempsey's correspondence. He was the general manager of Aer Lingus. He was appointed in 1943. He's quite a legendary character within Aer Lingus, very dynamic character. But he wrote to the Department of Industry and Commerce just after the Second World War, and he said morale is on the floor. There are staff resignations. There's absenteeism. And you've got to take the funding of Aer Lingus seriously.
Right, so he was looking for more money to drive the business on.
Oh, very much. You know, and you're still talking about Britain and then the possibilities for the continent. There are no transatlantic flights for Aer Lingus until 1958. Now, there was an agreement between Ireland and the United States from 1945 that they would seek to operate these transatlantic flights, but they would land in Shannon. And this was a crucial development in relation to the significance of Shannon Airport. And Shannon Airport was first used in 1945. That remained quite a controversial and emotive issue right up to the early 1990s. Mm-hmm. By 1973, it was accepted due to political pressure, and there was a lot of diplomatic wrangling about this, that American Airlines could fly direct to Dublin. But there was a compulsory Shannon stopover because you had to satisfy the lobby from the West, because the idea of getting rid of Shannon as a compulsory stop-off for America, that would have decimated tourism in the West, as they saw it. And I mean, this became a very toxic issue right up to 1994 when the direct flights were authorised.
So J.F. Dempsey, who you mentioned there, was a very dynamic figure. Was it that he could see the economic potential?
Oh, very much.
In what Aer Lingus
he also wanted to develop a corporate culture, that this was an opportunity to marry nationalism and national pride in the airline with entrepreneurial spirit. And Aer Lingus would have been the first airline, for example, to charter flights to Lourdes in the 1950s. And then you had the whole transatlantic dimension. But it wasn't just about what was going on in Dublin. You go over to American cities, for example, and you open up offices there. You try and recruit staff from American airlines so that you're not trying to do everything from an Irish perspective, mm-hmm, with Irish people, that you're also looking to try and build more of a sense of an airline that is internationally relevant, but also very modern and can adapt.
You become a player internationally in the
aviation
market.
About, you know, bringing new management techniques to the staff in Aer Lingus. A lot of the early staff in Aer Lingus at a senior level were former military personnel. They were very gruff. They were very autocratic. They knew very little about commerce. And Dempsey and Michael Dargan, who was later chief executive in the 1960s, they were pushing this idea of training and of Dublin and Dublin Airport becoming a significant centre when it came to the whole business of flying, but also managing staff issues, particularly when it came to what became a very large staff. I mean, Aer Lingus by the 1970s had a staff of 6,000 people. And by the 1980s, it's estimated that there were 30 trade unions that were relevant to the workforce in Aer Lingus. So there were huge personnel challenges.
Yeah. Michael Dargan, you mentioned there, he came in the 60s. So this was after they've had their first transatlantic flight in 1958.
He worked his way up the ranks. He actually came in as a civil servant in the Department of Posts and Telegraphs, and he persuaded Dempsey, the general manager, that he needed a personnel officer. And then he worked his way up, eventually becoming chief executive in the late 1960s. Now, he was admired and respected rather than liked, I would say, because he could be quite ruthless in terms of the need for new administrative structures and managerial innovations and developments. And he was a man for reshuffling and culling as well. So there were a lot of controversies, but he was also adamant about the direction which it needed to go. There were mistakes made. I mean, Aer Lingus became an all-jet airline from 1967 to 1970, and that actually curtailed its options in some respects because the focus shifted away from the short haul, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there were outlandish prices for first class flying with Aer Lingus in the early days, where you could go gold shamrock and you could get your lobster and your champagne and have a whole lounge area. But it was ludicrously expensive.
Fabulous.
And yeah, fabulous if you could afford it. The difficulty from Dargan's perspective, I suppose, was that he didn't want the airline to become associated exclusively with elite travellers. Mm-hmm. So he was presaging, I suppose, some of the debates that came later.
But
too.
Back in the day, air travel was so glamorous. I mean, that was personified by the air stewardesses, the most glamorous people on earth,
Well, they were first appointed in 1946. Now, to be a stewardess on Aer Lingus, you had to be an ideal specimen of Irish womanhood. That was the description at the time. Now, what did that involve? You had to be between the age of 21 and 26, to be between 5'2" and 5'9", to be between 7.5 stone and 9 stone in weight. You were not allowed to smoke. You were not allowed to drink. You couldn't chew gum. You were certainly not allowed to cycle to work. They were discouraged from talking politics or religion or anything risque with the customers.
We've all been ruled out here on many grounds.
No chance. You were forbidden from exchanging telephone numbers. Now, how many of the stewardesses lived up to this is another matter. But the bar was set very high for the lovely girls. And the stipulations at the time went on to insist that they had to have tact and dignity and poise and charm and be well educated. Mm-hmm. These were much sought after jobs. And of course, once you got married,
you were out.
You were out. Mm-hmm. Aer Lingus staff magazine used to feature married women being presented with a gift, the staff magazine, but it was really a going away present.
On the way out the door.
Yeah.
But the Aer Lingus staff across the board, I mean, not just the air stewardesses, they had a lot of prestige,
oh,
didn't
they? Yeah. Michael Callaghan, who was appointed a pilot in 1962, he was interviewed a couple of years ago when Aer Lingus was being absorbed into the bigger conglomerate. And he looked back at the early 1960s, you know, and the status that they had and the prestige that they had. They were the gods. Mm-hmm. But there was also, I suppose, during that period, a sense that they were carrying more than just the job of flying the planes, that they were carrying the national reputation. And of course, you can exaggerate that to a degree, but I think a lot of people felt that, that the shamrock on the planes meant something significant. And particularly for a country that had experienced such an exodus, Aer Lingus was very much associated with homecomings as well. And the idea that your trip home was not just beginning when you landed in Dublin or Shannon, it began when you got on an Aer Lingus plane. Mm-hmm. And that sense of them having to exemplify the best of Irishness, and not just in relation to the actual planes. And of course, there were dark days for Aer Lingus too. The Tusker Rock tragedy in March 1968, when a flight from Cork to Heathrow went down, the last distress message at 12,000 feet, descending and spinning rapidly. It was the darkest day for Aer Lingus. 61 people on board were killed. All on board were killed. And that also put a spotlight on maintenance and the issue of air safety as well. So, you know, these were always very challenging tasks in relation to keeping up to date with the latest developments in safety.
And then when we come to the 1980s, things really begin to change because we have the open skies policy, don't we?
Which upended. Aer Lingus was indulged for so long because there were cartels in operation, and it had a monopoly on the Dublin-London route, which was the busiest route, of course. Now, in 1984, it was £209 or 209 punts to fly that route, which in the 1980s, nearly 40 years ago, was an exorbitant sum. I mean, we'd be given out today if we were asked to pay €209 to fly to London. But Aer Lingus, you see, it had that advantage. But here is one of the ironies, I think, that it was very important for emigrants, but they became a very important lobbying group in lobbying the Irish government to break that monopoly because it was exorbitantly expensive. And Ryanair were allowed by the Irish government in 1985 to come into that space. And boy, did they make the most of it. They had a fare at one stage in the early days that was 57% cheaper than Aer Lingus.
So their business model then is completely changed.
Oh, it is. I mean, a decade later, Ryanair had 36% of that Dublin-London market and Aer Lingus only had 35%. Mm-hmm. And of course, Aer Lingus was also facing personnel difficulties, union difficulties, and was facing bankruptcy at various stages in the very late 20th century and the early 21st century. And there were various rescue plans and restructurings. And of course, you had the deregulation European-wide of air travel, the open skies policies. Aer Lingus had to adopt to that. And like really, it had three options, you know, to stay as it was, to become a low-cost carrier, or to become a hybrid. It tried all of those three different approaches. Mm. And it achieved a degree of success in the early 21st century. But Aer Lingus was never just about the planes and the flying. It was also about diversification from the 1960s onward. It started buying land, it started buying hotels, it started developing Dublin as a hub for other airlines, it started leasing aircraft. So, you know, the business models changed at various stages.
Now, no one's going to say that Aer Lingus has the status now that it had historically when we're looking at the 40s and the 50s and 60s, but it still has a unique place.
It does. I mean,
it
became privatised, the government sold its stake, yeah. It was absorbed into that much larger conglomerate. So the Shamrock has been wilting for some time, and yet there is still a very strong national feeling about Aer Lingus, even if it doesn't have that status and even if the economics around it has changed at home and internationally, people still have a very strong feeling about Aer Lingus, for many a very strong affinity with Aer Lingus, and they associate it often with very memorable moments in their own lives or in their extended family's lives. So it does carry that. And again, because of the way in which it developed and because of its association with the foundation years of the state and the early decades of the state, I think it will always carry more resonance mm-hmm. than some of the other airlines. And there are people working in Aer Lingus who communicate in a very different way from some of the other aircraft carriers. I remember being on an Aer Lingus flight last year and the woman in charge of the flight was going up and down. These were Leaving Cert students on their way off to Greece, and there had been terrible tragedies with some Leaving Cert students, and she gave them a right talking to.
Good for her.
And she had a Leaving Cert student of similar age at home, and she made that point. You wouldn't have got that from someone working with a different airline.
Possibly not. And I'm sure there are people who've had their flights cancelled this morning who are very interested to hear all about the history of Aer Lingus as they await the outcome of those Labour Court talks later on today. Dermot, thank you so much. Lovely to have you with us. That's Professor Dermot Ferriter. Now, Hurricane Beryl is on a trail of destruction right across the Caribbean. We're going to find out more about that next.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.